first of all, introduce myself. I'm Jim Knutson, and have spent a life involved in global mission. My wife and I were missionaries in South Africa from 1954 to 1972. And from 1973 and on, I've been a secretary in the mission office of the church with the ALC until the merger, and then went to Chicago for 2 years with the ELCA. And my responsibilities with the ALC and ELCA have been as a secretary for Africa. With the ALC, I related to all of Africa, all of the involvement the ALC had in Africa. With the LCA, with the ELCA, it was French-speaking West Africa and Southern Africa. So my main area, I guess, of expertise would be Southern Africa, and as you probably have seen by the program, the next 3 days I'm going to be talking about South Africa, about issues there, about the challenges there for us. But in talking with the teaching, some of the program directors before, we decided it would be good to have one session on Senegal in here. It's entirely different. It's a rather new area for us in our church, and if you're from other churches, I'm sure it's still, I think every church is wrestling with the whole matter in one way or another of a relationship with Islam, whether it's in an overseas setting like Senegal or another country or in the United States. And I want to say right away, you shouldn't start with a disclaimer, but I am not an expert on Islam, and this is not going to be a seminar on Islam. I worked in South Africa among people who, if they were not Christian, were involved in what is called traditional African religion, sometimes called animism, which is not too good a word. But I was involved as a secretary in the ALC from the time we started work in Senegal until I left the office last year. So I've been involved as a secretary, as an enabler to the people who have been involved in ministry in Senegal. And therefore, I thought it would be good for us to think a little bit about what in the world is the church doing in a Muslim country. And of course, the whole matter of relationship to Muslims takes on added interest and goes far beyond what we can touch in a few minutes when we think of what's going on in the Middle East. I mean, we can't get into that. It's very important. It's all a part of a piece. But there are many, many differences and many, many variations. We are going to look at some slides. The slides are going to focus on the involvement of the ELCA in Senegal. And if you're from another church, it may be similar to what your churches are doing in some other parts of the world. But our frame of reference for Senegal is what the ELCA is doing. Now, when we just hear the word Islam, of course, it evokes many images. And right now, I suppose we think of all kinds of things, and they're not all positive images. There are about 1 billion Muslims in the world today. Out of what do we say the population of the world is now? Five or no? Is it more? And it's growing. Some people say it could well be the largest single religious family in the world. In Africa, about 40 to 45% of the people are Islam are Muslim, and basically, the line that you can draw in Africa is just about, you can just about draw a line across Africa. You can draw it across Nigeria, you can draw it across down in Central Africa. Sudan, of course, is split north and south. Ethiopia, and then down in here, and then eastern Tanzania. Pretty much north of here, if there is an organized religion, is Islam, and south of here, it's either Christianity or traditional African religion. And so Africa is almost divided there. Islam, too, interesting enough, as you know, is one of the three great religions in the world, which traces its origins to the same place. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all come from the Middle East and have overlaps, and basically all, you might say, except the Old Testament, and we have that common root, and Abraham is our father for all of us. So there are many, many, many interesting things that one could go into there, and we're just going to touch it briefly to set the context. Of course, you know they believe there's one God, is Allah. Muhammad was his prophet. The Quran was given to Muhammad. It came from heaven. It just came right out of heaven. It was inspired and divine, and therefore every word is holy and every word has power. And you can even I'm not an expert, but I've seen it in Senegal, when they can write the Quran on a slate and then wash that with water, and you drink that water and you get power, because there's power in the word. Jesus, and some of you, there may be some of you who know a lot about, you know that Jesus, of course, is a great prophet in their tradition, a very great man. But he's not true God of true God. He's not true God begotten of the Spirit, of the Holy Spirit. In their practices, there are a number of things. Some of the basic pillars, again, the word Islam means submission to God, and that gives you a clue right there. Submission to God. And the Muslim is one who has submitted, a submissive one. That's the key, submission to God. Not so much God's gift, God's love, but submission to God. Fasting is very important, and there's a month of Ramadan when you don't eat between sundown. I mean, you don't eat between sunup and sundown. You eat at night, and all day you fast. Prayer five times a day wherever you are. The men, you don't see the women doing this visibly. The men, I've seen them do it in airports. Someone told me they'd seen it on an airplane. I haven't seen that, but I can believe it. I've seen it in airports. I've seen it all over the Africa. I've seen ferry boats stop and wait for half an hour. You couldn't cross on the ferry boat in Nigeria because the ferry captain was doing his prayer. How would that work if a Christian tried that? Say, wait, I'm going to go and pray for half an hour. We're going to stop the ferry boat. But it's a really challenge to us. Pilgrimage to Mecca, if you can make it, of course. Almsgiving, helping, especially helping fellow Muslims. There are many other things, but these are some of the pillars. Now, there are various forms, and I'm not an expert on those, but there are some very radical ones, and they're the ones that get the headlines. That always happens. The Shiites, you know, the radicals, that in any society, in any religion. What are some of the issues between Christians and Muslims as far as our relationship? Well, some of the things I've touched on would already give you some clues. One thing we need to remember, and this is something that people who have worked with Muslims remind us, the Muslims still remember the Crusades. They haven't forgotten. And we're told that in the 1090s, in 1090, right in that era, right at that time, 70,000 men, women, and children were killed in Jerusalem just during a few years, and the Christians who came down thought they were doing God a favor. So, I mean, that's part of the history. That's what some of them know most about Christianity, is what the Christians did in the Crusades. As an expert on Islam has said, Dr. Roland Miller from Canada, who spent many years in India, historically relationships have been very bad, historically. Both sides are loaded with misunderstandings and caricatures, both sides. They say that we are tritheists. That's the biggest heresy. We believe in three gods. There's one God, Allah. And you Christians, you have three gods. You have God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. There can't be three gods. That is the big blasphemy. It's utter blasphemy. And again, then how Jesus cannot be true God, because he just can't. God can't be, you can't have three gods. Another one that is pointed out by Muslims who do dialogue with Christians, they say, what is different about you except your theology, which is unacceptable? We don't see anything in your behavior really to attract us or to let us, make us think that is Christianity is any better. So we know your theology is different. Also today, of course, and some of you know this very well, as they look at our Western world and they see the decadence, the immorality, the pornography, etc., 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 they say, and they put that all together, that's the Christian world. If that's what Christianity is, we don't want it. We don't want it. But yet things are changing for them, and they're caught in this very ambiguous situation where they want to live in the modern world, and obviously very modern, very, you know, the technological world, and yet they see that there's erosion of some of their beliefs, and they see what their young people want, and see what some of their women want, and all of that. And how do you keep all this together? How do you keep the old values, and yet you have to be part of the modern world economically and so forth? You're not going to be involved economically if you don't. So that there's real ambiguity there. And so there's defensiveness, there's paranoia. They want to be a part of the modern world and yet keep all of the old. Well, those are just some of the points of attention, very briefly, as we move very soon to Senegal. As we think of involvement in Senegal and our church's involvement there, Senegal is the westernmost tip of Africa. I think most of you know that. It's far the western point. Sticks out there. It's about the size of the state of Nebraska. It's always helpful to have some kind of comparison. There are nearly 7 million people. The names of some of the groups are Wolof, Serer, Tukulor, and Fulani. Tukulor and Fulani both speak Fulani, but they're two groups, different groups of people. Dakar, the area, the city out on the peninsula, has between 2 and 3 million. They say pretty soon, it's definitely 2 million in the metropolitan area. And as people move in, that peninsula, they say pretty soon it's going to have half the people of the country. Because the country, as you're going to see, is pretty arid. It's not easy to make a living, and so people flocking to town because maybe they'll get a job in town. There's evidence about 600 AD that people moved in here, coming across, settled in there. The first ones were the Wolof and the Serer. And there's a tremendously interesting history here. Wars, struggles, power struggles. And then Islam, when Islam came in here a little bit later, there were more struggles with Africans. The Africans here were not originally Muslim. Then to complicate it, the Portuguese came rolling by. They didn't stay. The French came and they stayed. 1638, the French said, this is our corner of Africa. And they built, their first city was Saint Louis, St. Louis. same as we've got after the French came. And they stayed there, and there were fights back and forth, extremely interesting history. But in 1815, they consolidated their hold, and they said, this is our country. And so Senegal became a French colony in every sense of the word in 1815. In 1960, it became an independent republic. So now we're going to look at the slides and try to weave in some of the things that that I've touched on and deal with the question I posed. Are there any questions that you have that, if I think we're going to deal with it later, I'll tell you, but yes?
Does Islam have any kind of a messianic figure? Or is that not necessary?
There are you're going to get me in deep water so fast here, but there are movements. Like in Senegal, there are three movements. And really, the heads of those movements are very messianic. They are powerful, powerful people. And you'll see their pictures in all the homes and on the sides of buses and taxis. I would say in that sense, I don't know. Very powerful heads of brotherhoods. And that person is more in real and alive to them, say, than Muhammad would be, because he's far away. Sort of like in African, you know, African religion, Christians. There are Christian messianic leaders in Africa, and they'll be more real to the people, of course, than Jesus.
I was thinking of in terms of the need for redemption or having strayed from God's will.
Well, there would be correctives. You know, there would be movements. Some of the reform movements are that, to correct that they've gone astray, they've perverted the message, you know. Yes, Bonnie?
They believe in a life after death?
Yeah, there's a life after death. And there are different ones. I know one of the beliefs that they have is a paradise, especially for the men, where there's lots of time to sit around, lots of women, and it's beautiful, you know, sort of. But, you know, so they do. But again, it's very male-centered, as you know. The thing. Okay, we can get the blinds. One of the symbols of Senegal is the baobab tree, or cream of tartar tree. How many people here have traveled? Has anyone here been in Senegal? Anyone, how many of you have been in Africa? Okay, lots of people. Which parts of Africa?
Algiers.
Where else?
Egypt. North and south.
You've been all over.
And east.
Yeah. Okay, baobab tree, the cream of tartar tree. You see in parts of East Africa too. And it's a symbol also of Senegal in certain parts. This is actually the road out to one of the areas where the Lutheran Church is now working. But the scene that you see here along the North Road, which runs along the northern part of the country, is also very typical. Two things are very typical. The sand, and over the hill you see the Twin Towers, and you know that's a mosque. And some of the tiny towns, the villages in rural Senegal, will have two or three or four mosques. Different rich people will build a mosque for themselves. And I used to say it's like coming into town and seeing, before our merger, LCA, ALC, and Missouri Synod all in one town. Tiny town with three or four mosques. Because remember now, maybe I didn't say that, but 90% of the people, 90% of the people are Muslim. A few percent are Christian, Roman Catholic. When the wind blows, that's what it looks like. And there's not much to hold it down. We'll talk later about some of the causes of that and some of the struggles. During the winter, our winter, they're still far enough north, so their winter in quotes, which is still warmer than ours, but they're far enough north so it gets cool. They have what they call a harmattan. The harmattan is the high dust coming out of the Sahara. So that air, when you look outside, you think, hey, maybe the first day it's fog. It's not, it's brown, it's dust. The whole air is literally full of fine dust from the Sahara. Plus, when you get the wind, you get the ground. Sort of like us getting a snowstorm and a blizzard at the same time, you know. Some is coming from the top and some is going along the ground. Very typical scene up in northern Senegal. And I should say that, add that the involvement of our church, the Lutheran Church, is basically in the northern part of the country and then in the city of Dakar itself. And the northern part is the part closest to the desert. It's in an area called Sahel, S-A-H-E-L. It's an Arabic word meaning the shore or the edge of the desert. It's just the next belt south of the Sahara. If you have any questions, pop up and, you know, ask them. And if they are too complicated, we'll try to talk about them later. But if you have questions about the pictures, please feel free to.
I just wanted to ask,
yes,
these little towns with their own mosques, are the chanters real and alive, or are they real?
Yeah, the chanters, the call to prayer. We talked about the five times call to prayer. And those of you who have been in, especially we have people from North Africa, they're up in these towers. In the small towns, it'll be more real. But in the bigger cities, they'll have the recordings. And they'll put on a recording. And I've got a picture of the largest mosque in the country and probably in West Africa. And that's all recording. And we had a joke when we went by there once. We said, wouldn't it be fun to go up there and put on some Christian recordings when they push the button in the morning and you get something about Jesus. It wasn't very nice, but we didn't dare. This is what much of northern Senegal looks like. A couple things are happening. There have been two droughts, and we'll touch that off and on during these minutes. Heavy drought, bad drought in the 70s, another one in the 80s. Another thing, trees are cut down for charcoal. One of the tremendous problems in Africa is fuel, is how to get energy, especially to cook. And the cities have nothing, there's no coal, and so what happens is people go out and burn trees and make charcoal and haul it into the cities. So you have more and more of that problem of trees being cut for charcoal. So you have the drought, you have the charcoal industry, and then of course you have grazing. We'll talk a little bit about that as we go along. One of Senegal's an ambivalent thing, really, ambiguous, is that the French came in and the French decided what the cash crop should be for Senegal, as colonial powers often did. They decided which crop, whether it should be cocoa or, you know, depending on the climate, cotton, cocoa, peanuts, coffee, tea. And it's good in the sense it does give Senegal some foreign exchange. These are peanuts. They do get foreign exchange. But the bad thing is, some farmers grow peanuts instead of growing cash crops, and some farmers have gone in and plowed up land that should never have been plowed. Does that sound familiar? And the dirt blows and the wind blows, and maybe they get one good crop and they get rain, and then they get a drought, and then that peanut plowed land is just desert again. So, and then it makes them vulnerable because peanuts is your big crop, and if the people overseas don't want peanuts, the price goes down. They're very much tied to France economically. Cattle and goats and sheep, again, originally the herders, especially the Fulani, and that's the people among whom our church has been trying to work basically, were cattle herders because obviously much of that land, that's what it was suited for, like much of our West. It's okay for cattle. The problem gets to be when there get to be too many in some places, or when there get to be, when there's a few good years and then you get drought and the herds have increased in the meantime. This is around a watering hole up in northern Senegal. And you see all the herders in the back, mostly young men and boys, have brought their cattle together to this watering place. Another one, very typical, the French, together with the Senegalese government, dug deep wells across northern Senegal, wells that go down thousands of, actually like 1,000 meters, and then pull up the water and have long watering troughs for the cattle and the livestock, and then the people can come and get water too. The problem is that for miles around, that area is just trampled, I mean around there. Now in the rainy season, which is a couple months, then there's enough water so that they can drink out of little streams and little potholes kind of back in the bush. But when the dry season comes, everybody converges here. So they're used to this kind of life and stock raising and so forth, but it also has its problematic side. There again, the people up north, you got to have wood, you got to have fuel, so you have that whole business with the trees. Very typical means of transportation. Very clever kind of cart, very clever design, and using a one-horse cart. Senegal is very flat. It's one of the flattest countries in Africa. The highest point is about 500 feet. So in that sense, that kind of transportation is really pretty good. And even though it gets kind of sandy, they've got the tires, so. Typical of the area in northern Senegal, in the area where the Lutheran Church is working. That is really what you call Sahel. Now you see there's some grass there. The grass has grown during the rainy season. Some of that grass is good for grazing, some of it isn't. Taken a few years ago by one of our missionaries, that was a road, a main road where people travel, and of course when it gets too deep you keep moving over. And that's really not too good for the ecology either, but if you want to get through there, yeah, that's what you have to do. And you don't stop, as you know, if you drive in sand, the last thing you do is stop. You go down, 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 down. The good thing about sand is you're not going to freeze to death if you get stuck, like you go with snow. The bad thing is that there's no bottom sometimes. With snow, sometimes you're going to hit the bottom, but you just go down and down. Typical village of the Fulani up in the northern part of Senegal, north central part. The Fulani people have been nomadic people, but to some extent it's been modified. Some people even call them semi-nomadics. And by that we mean the village may stay where it is, and the children and the women and maybe the old people. But during the dry season, the men and the boys will take the cattle and maybe go down south, maybe a couple hundred miles. Now traditionally they would move all over the place with their cattle. But more recently you have more of this pattern where the whole family will not move. But you'll say, where are the men or the young men? They're down, they've taken the cattle down farther south where there's better winter pasture. Typical kind of using what you have, the grass and the mud and sticks, and filling up all the cracks around there with thorns. Keep out, either keep the goats in or out. Goats are the worst thing in the world. I used to think pigs were bad, but I think goats are worse. I think they can get through anything.
Are the animals for consumption or for sale?
Both. Both. Yeah. Again, a typical home. Grass has been cut. They're lucky. They live in there where there's some grass, and of course they can re-roof their roofs or the walls if they're using grass walls. But there also is the city of Dakar. This is Place de l'Independence, the Independent Square, the center of Dakar. Dakar is an amazingly modern city right in the middle. So it's a tourist city. A lot of Europeans, French, Germans. So beautiful hotels right downtown. The ocean is just a few blocks to your left. Very nice downtown area. and you think, you know, it's quite a modern place. Look out from one of those buildings and you get a mixed picture. This is looking out obviously toward the harbor, toward the Atlantic Ocean. Mixed picture of a commercial area, a market area. That round building in the middle with the round roof is a market. To the other side, and I don't have a picture of that, there you get more into the slum areas, so-called. And then there's another area along the coast. We have beautiful buildings. The people working in embassies and you know, ambassadors, consulates, business people, some beautiful housing. Offshore from Dakar is the infamous island of Gorée, G-O-R-E-E. Gorée is infamous because you see that fortress-like thing on the left. Just behind that is a building. It was a slave dungeon. This was a slave dungeon, and thick walls, and one part the women would be, one part the children, one part the men. As far as I can figure out from visiting there a number of times and talking to people, the children are also separated. Maybe not, I don't think the nursing children, but they're all separated according to age. And upstairs, the Dutch captain who ran this had his apartment upstairs. Now, we all know the history, or something of the history of slavery. We know that how that was accepted by people, even Christians, by European governments, and by the people in the United States. But it's a chilling thing to go into a place like that. They have pictures, and you've seen pictures in history books, and maybe you've seen TV series, how they laid these slaves down like cordwood in these ships, and how many died. Sometimes half of them died before they got to the States, to the Western world. But they went out through that door, and they had small boats there, and then they took them out to the bigger boats and took them across to our part of the world, to the Western Hemisphere. And they've kept it now as a reminder. And anyone who's important who comes to Senegal will visit there, whether it's one of our senators, representatives, or cabinet from our cabinet, or people from all over the world. They've signed, they have things up from all over the world. And it's a tough place to go because for blacks from America, you can imagine. I can't imagine, but I can barely imagine how they feel. And for us whites, even though for many of us, maybe our ancestors weren't even around, they were all involved in it. We're part of it. Senegal is not an Islamic republic. It's the French call it a lay republic. We would say a secular state. In other words, it's not an Islamic state like many of the countries in the world. And the first president of Senegal was Léopold Senghor. Some of you have heard that. He's a poet. S-E-N-G-H-O-R. S-E-N-G-H, yeah. And he was a Roman Catholic because he was the most qualified person at the time of independence to take over the leadership. So here was a Roman Catholic president of a largely Muslim country. The second president, Abdou Diouf, is a Muslim. And he was the right-hand man, and he was handpicked and chosen by Senghor. That's the presidential palace, the flag. It's one of the few countries in Africa that has multi-parties. There are 17 parties, which is kind of confusing. But it has a multi-party system anyway. This is right near the downtown and near the ocean. It's just a few blocks again behind. Senegalese people, as I mentioned, there are Wolof, the main language. There are the Serere in the south, and there are the Fulani and the Tukulor. They're related. They have a little different background, but they're Fulani speaking. Fulani is a language which is spoken by people across all. There's a belt of Fulani people stretching from Senegal way over into Central African Republic. About 13 million people or so speak that language, which is really an Arabic type language. It sounds like Arabic and has the same kind of sounds, and even the script, if they use their own script. Up in the northern part, you can see by the sand. The Fulani are beautiful people. They're often you can tell who is it true. Like the woman on the left, I mean, you can tell. Just a little different from, say, the what we would think of as Bantu Africans, or say black, what some people would say black now. That's where it came from. See it, Tom? Now, water, as you could already guess from seeing the countryside, is one of the tremendous problems, and in a number of places they're lucky enough to have wells, hand-dug wells, but the work involved in pulling up water by hand with those pulleys and buckets, and you see men and women, you see more women around there, but you also see men and women, as in this case, water for the livestock, water for the home. Of course, you can imagine you're not going to waste water in your home if you have to pull it up like this and in some cases carry it. This is an ongoing struggle. Some of our missionaries have been involved in some of this. There are places where to dig a well, it's so terribly expensive to go real deep, and sometimes shallow wells don't work, so it's an unending struggle. Again, another well, up again in the area where our people have been involved. And when you have to carry it, you find different ways of carrying it. Mm-hmm. And that's one way that's becoming more and more common. He may have to, I don't know, you know, this man may have to go 6-10 miles, who knows, back to where he lives. Well, sorghum in this country, milo, I guess sometimes we call it, and what they call millet. Their millet is a different from ours, but it's a cereal, and they pound it, and they pound it, and that's their staple. That's their, well, potatoes, or in some countries that would be rice, but in northern Senegal, it's either millet or sorghum, and that's the basic thing you eat. Sometimes you may not have anything else to eat. You may, from time to time, you know, have a goat, kill a goat or a chicken, but your basic diet. And if you're lucky, you and we'll talk about that, we'll see some of the gardens. If you have a garden, then you might have something else. This is back-breaking, time-consuming work, which you see throughout much of Africa. And luckily, in some villages, they'll have a little mill, a grinding mill. That's not possible always. That's expensive, too. And so this is what you see in most places. Women also are involved in building houses. This varies. In South Africa, where we lived and served, and there the men did the house building, but here women, and you see how they're building it. It's very interesting. The saplings are bent over and then tied with bark, and then they'll thatch that with grass. Markets, women are the ones selling the vegetables. Now, this area up in the north, where when the rains, you have the gardens, and we'll also talk about how the church has been involved in some of the gardens. You see, that's a pretty good choice there for people who have the money to buy some vegetables. Tomato time up in northern Senegal.
What are the men doing while all these women are doing building houses?
Some of them are doing nothing. Some of them are praying 5 times a day. Some of them are in the car working, the car, not I sometimes am accused of not enunciating, and once when we had a new secretary in Minneapolis doing dictation back in the word processing, and I had said in my letter, according to the conversation we had in the car, and it came back, according to the conversation we had in the car. This is the men are in the car, or, interestingly enough, they're in Paris. And it's been interesting to me as I traveled in northern Senegal in those tiny little villages to sit down and start talking, of course, with an interpreter, and find out one son is in Paris. Way back in the backwoods of Senegal. Because of that connection, a close connection, and the fact that there might be work in Paris, and as you know, Paris is full of people from the former colonies. Some are on boats. They're you know, ship hands on boats. So Dan, there are different things.
Do they still teach back in those villages? French is one of the languages?
Well, French is the lingua franca of Senegal. So they would teach it in the school, right? The school would be the language, that would be the language of instruction. Because and if they ever go on to high school or university, which a few would be able to do, that's the language. So they start out with French school from the beginning, and they're pretty fluent.
Who runs the school?
School is run by the government. The government It's obviously not, you know, there are holes in their system, but there are schools. The government runs the schools. Government pays the teachers. Some of the schools, well, they're not really, I don't think there's a picture here, there should have been, of the school. Not very fancy buildings, you know, pretty simple kinds of buildings. Equipment is not too fancy, but the government is trying very hard to educate its people, to promote literacy. It's a rather enlightened government, I'd say, even though it has faces tremendous problems.
Jim, what would be the language of the market? French and the native language?
Up here it would be Fulani. And when you get down south in Dakar and south, it would be Wolof, which is entirely different. But around here, they'd be throwing Fulani around. And that's a tough language. Our missionaries who struggle with that and others, if they learn the proper Fulani, tell me it's a very, very difficult language.
What do the Fulani and the Wolof speak to each other?
I think they just go back and forth. They understand each other.
Uh-huh.
Especially those that go to town. There's a market, you know, they just have to survive. There you see sifting for the sorghum and that. You see tomato cans that are cleaned and sold. You see the pots, you see the cloth. Typical market. Towns will have different days for market days. So one day, people who have some of these wares, like this man in the middle, will move from market to market in the general area, and the others will come to market in their particular village. That's a wonderful place to get to know people and sit and talk to people. There's the Touba Mosque, the one where we wanted to get up and put the tape. You can see it wouldn't have been so easy. It's magnificent. It rises out of the the prairie. I mean, it's absolutely flat up there, and for miles away you see this thing. And this is a brotherhood, and they control that city. They have their own police. So more and more our people and other people, unless they have business in town, will go around. They have a bypass now. But we have gone through there, and we've been in the mosque. It's called Touba, T-O-U-B-A. And they tell us it's one of the largest in West Africa, and I think it is, because I have been in Nigeria, and I've been in some, you know, Cameroon, some of the other countries where there are Muslims, and I've never seen anything like it. I don't know, you know, Egypt, I'm sure, has bigger ones, but for West. And it's beautiful. And they're building, they're extending. And people make pilgrimages here, people from Senegal, do not have the money to go to Mecca.
Is this near Dakar?
It's about 80 miles, 80, 90 miles, I'm guessing. I'm trying to know. There's the prayer. I wished I had some other pictures of prayer, you know, people doing it right on the streets or in the airport, but this is right along the street. They'll stop and there'll be a prayer mat, or they'll carry their own prayer mat and their tea kettle to wash their hands and feet and pray five times a day. And then, as Peter said, you hear the call to prayer, and if you live near a mosque and you are tired and you hear this thing before dawn, you know, and it's best if it's a recording and it goes on and on and on, you get angry at the man, and you also think, maybe I should get up and pray too. Here I, lazy Christian, lying here criticizing them for calling people to prayer, you know. Now to more directly talk about the involvement of the Lutheran Church. Apologies to those of you who aren't from the church, but that's our framework. There was a long discussion in the ALC, a predecessor body, because in Nigeria, in Cameroon, in Central African Republic, our missionaries and the African Church had been working with Muslims. There are Muslims all over, and then. Also the radio studio. Some of you remember the Radio Voice of the Gospel at his advent, which had a powerful transmitter. And one of the beams came into West Africa in the Fulani language, beaming programs into West Africa. This was the Lutheran World Federation. So after a lot of discussion, they said, well, look, we're touching the surface here, but there's a whole belt of Fulani across West Africa. What about them? Do we just ignore them? Do we just let them go by? And so, to make a long, long story short, in about 73-74, the ALC at that time made the decision, and the church council ratified it, to go and begin new mission work in West Africa. It was supported by the United Mission Appeal, which was very important. The church had money at that time to begin some new endeavors. The first missionaries who went there were couple that had served in Cameroon, Sig and Flo Larson.
And the man in the middle, he can't see you, young agriculturist, Roger Steinkamp. The thing is, they were sent there to begin, after there had been survey and a decision to start to work in the north, they were there to begin to just to get to know people along the northern part of the, along the river from San Luis and up along the Senegal River. So there, that's a picture of them in one of those early months going out and getting acquainted with people. They had worked in Cameroon, they knew French, they knew some Fulani, they didn't know as much as they should have, but we were all in a hurry to get people out there, so they went in with their French and some Fulani, began to make contacts. What do you do when you come into an Islamic area like that? First of all, you can say, why are you there? What in the world are you trying to do? And that's what we'll talk about afterwards. But here we are, feeling that the church has a valid mission there, as valid there as in other parts of Africa or other parts of America or wherever. So we realize that you work with the people, you try to build relationships with the people, you try to find out where they're at, and very early on, the realization dawned that these people, of course, are either cattle people or they have gardens or they do both. So some of the missionaries that were sent out earlier, like the Barons, this is Bill and Sue Barron from South Dakota, we looked for people who were either were farmers, agriculturalists, who knew something about forestry, who knew something about water, or were in the health field. The Barons, he'd had theological training, he hadn't been ordained yet, and he also was a farmer, he worked with livestock and with crops. So they were working up in the north with people with gardens, and one of the things that was done, and there on the right is Jane Rossing, who has just returned. She's a sister of Barb Rossing, who was program director here this summer and former pastor here. Some of you that have been in Holden know Barb Rossing. That's her sister Jane. On the left here, Gibson, a new man, a new missionary whose specialty is in goats, raising goats. He has a degree, a PhD now. He's had African experience before, PhD from the University of Indiana, I think it is, and he's worked in Arab goats, which is very, very relevant to that for that area. Well, now, the reason I show this picture is I was talking with Jane the other day. She was in the Twin Cities and was going on to graduate school. And she said, you know, tell the people that when we come into an area, we sit down and talk to the people. And that's true. We don't just come in and say, let's do this or this. We sit down, and in this case, they had established relationship because we've been around that part of Senegal since 76, 77. Find out what their interests are, what their concerns are, what their needs are, and then try to see, is there any way in which we as missionaries can be enablers? Now, these are all women, basically women here, and they're basically people who said in the end, we want gardens. We need gardens. We need better food for our families, and also, of course, we can sell from the gardens. There's Jane again with a group of women who had agreed that they wanted gardens. You can see the tiny plots that have already been laid out. And the women's organizations in northern Senegal are very unique along the river. They have their own organizations already. The missionaries didn't come up there and start them. And that was kind of, they plugged into that. There were people, there was usually one strong woman who was the chair of the group, and they had some little things they were doing, and now they said, we'd like to have gardens. And when they, in this particular case, and this is an experiment, the Belgian government gave money for solar pumps. And so they tried an experiment. They put a solar pump in the river. That's a long story. But the women had to agree to pay so much to help amortize that. Not the whole system, but a certain amount they had to amortize. And so they're discussing there how much they should give a year and then who should keep the money. And they designate one of their women as the one who should hold the money. It's very interesting. And Jane, as I have said many times, is a catalyst or an enabler, enabling them to do things for themselves. And the gardens, there are lots of things related to this garden. One is the water system. If you aren't fortunate to be a recipient of a solar pump from the Belgian government, you've got to haul your water. In this case, they're along the river, so they can haul it, but still they haul it that way in buckets, haul it up from the river. There again, you see, it's not the old clay pots, it's plastic buckets. I remember this picture. I didn't take all these pictures, but I took this one. They wanted me to take the pictures of their feet because one of the women had some new sandals. But I thought if I get that, why, they'll get kind of small. But I can still remember that. So take my shoes, take my shoes.
Are the women, let's see, how should I put this? Are the women the ones that are more receptive to Christianity?
Yeah, they're more receptive to doing things. They're just more receptive to... There's some interesting stories about these gardens, too. That is a branch of the Senegal River, so these people are lucky. They can haul it up by that way, and there was a solar pump. And then the missionaries have tried different things. There's no easy pattern. What you don't want to do is come in and do things for the people, lay something on them. On the other hand, you want to be able to enable them. And Jane, in another area, had a long discussion, and her congregation back in Illinois said, we'd like to give you money for a small pump, not a solar, just a small pump. And she debated a long time. Finally, she agreed with the women, they had many discussions, that they could have that pump, but they had to agree to pay so much a month for fuel and also a little kitty for repairs. And there are some young men along the river who have mechanical knowledge. You don't always find that, but there you did. So they had to pay for the fuel and the upkeep. And this thing started out pretty well. She doesn't know how it's going to go in the future, but it was an experiment. But then the men got excited when they saw what the women were doing, and they wanted a pump. But the women had already gone ahead and done it. And it's a good example for the men.
Do the women run these families pretty much, too?
A lot of them, sure, especially with the men. I mean, the men do the religious thing, and they go away to get money, but the care of the family, and many African societies, the women are the ones who are concerned with the care and the feeding of the children, and if they get money, they use that money for their children. Sometimes the men, if they get money, it'll go someplace else. So the women, if you're concerned about the health, and this sounds crazy, but because some of the big development projects in Africa, and there are a lot of research now, a lot of feedback, have come in and gathered a bunch of men. And they realize, you know, these aren't the people who are growing the food and feeding the families. It's the women. And more they've tried to get the women involved. Because they're the ones that are working. And that's there again, you see the typical African way of the baby on your back. You don't need a babysitter, but it's a lot of burden. This picture, if you get World Encounter, was on the cover of World Encounter. It's another, I say, happiness in Senegal is water for your garden or for your home. This is the area where they have a solar pump. And you can see the reservoir, kind of the outline behind there. So they have water, and you see some of the gardens in the background. Another way of doing it, of course, with watering cans, plastic cans. Women each have a little section, and there's competition between them, which is good. And sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it works. And our missionaries have been enablers and have been they've some technical advice. These people know a lot. They know how to live, but there may be a new variety of tomatoes or a new variety of lettuce. There are certain little things they can help them with. But it's still up to the women to come in there and water. And if they don't, of course, you know, it doesn't work. And the men's garden that they started one place, they just got tired of watering. And then one place, the young man that had some money wanted to hire other people to do the watering. You know, so. There you see onions in one of the gardens. So when grains, or when you bring the water in, this is John Salonika, one of the early missionaries who's now working for LWR in West Africa, Lutheran World Relief, who was one of the first who plugged into this. Now, there happened to be men there, but basically, I didn't take that picture, but John's work was 99% with women. And the same thing, these groups of women that wanted to do something and said, can you help us? And so I guess I wanted a picture of John, and so I took this one from a file, but he was one of the first who plugged into this possibility of working with these people. Gus Ziegler, excuse me.
How does the missionary work over there differ from the work of a Peace Corps worker?
Good question. Very good question. And that's partly answering the question that I put as a subject for this whole session. And then you put your finger on the center of it. I would answer this way, that unless a missionary, he or she is weeding in. First of all, let me back up. A missionary goes in conscious of the fact that he or she is a witness for Christ. Now, a Peace Corps worker could too, but he or she could not. I mean, a missionary is sent out there, say you're sent out to be a witness for Jesus Christ. And we know that you're not going to do a lot of speaking. You're not going to be standing on a soapbox in the villages. But we send you out, you're sent out as a witness for Jesus Christ, more deed than word, but weaving together, I've even thought of as a tapestry, that when the time comes, when the Spirit leads, when the opening is there, and it may be a long time, that you also verbalize, to put it simply, you name the name of Jesus. There is a time to name the name of Jesus. If you don't do that, if you aren't there with that consciousness, then and Peace Corps workers do a lot of good work. Then you can just, well, you know, Peace Corps or USAID. And one of our missionaries, I remember we were riding along one day and he said that. He said, unless we are conscious of being witnesses for Christ, you know, we're the same as government. So it's not to put down what the government and Peace Corps is doing, but it's, and we can talk more about that later. The people are very appreciative of what is being done. The women dance, and when some of us come from overseas or from the, you know, mission office, they want to show their thanks. They start dancing, and there's a woman, you cannot see her too well, on the lower left with a drum, and then the woman in the middle is dancing. And they will, if they know we're coming, they'll be ready there, and they'll go on and on and on. So sometimes the missionaries say, today we haven't got time, you know, we'll do it. And I've stood and watched this and been involved, and they give you pop and everything. But sometimes they'll say, we haven't told the people you're coming because we haven't got time for an hour or two of dancing today. Some days you do. And some of these old women, that's the same setting, you see. They are just terrific. I mean, they're just, they can go on for hours. And they have a certain way of dancing, of getting down, way down and up again. It's really fascinating. And the rest are clapping.
Some of these clothes are very neat. Are these special for special day, or is this every day? Because some of them look awfully.
Yeah, well, it's amazing. The clothes that they wear, the cloth that they buy, they have this artistic feeling. And this is different from much of Africa, where, I don't know, there's a certain sense these people have of buying, even when it's, you think it's kind of work clothes, and often a matching, you know, head scarf. And then if you stand in the car where you see the elite, the people that are working in the offices, you know, the people that have a little money, it's like a fashion show. I mean, they could come into New York and be models. And these are people just out. Now, obviously, these people probably knew that we were coming that day, or whoever was coming, you know, to visit. And then they'll put on a little nicer clothes. But they have this sense of, I don't know.
Color and design.
Color and design, right. Yep. tree seedlings in those tiny little envelopes. Those little, you can barely see the seed, but see their little envelopes. Because another big thing, obviously, in northern Senegal is reforestation. And again, our missionaries have been involved in that in a very small way, working with the government. The government has the tree nurseries, and the missionaries can come and get seedlings and then work with the people out in the villages. And that is a very difficult thing. There's a man with a little larger seedling. Most of them are very small. And you notice this one in this village, the elaborate protection, because the big thing you're fighting is goats. And a goat, as I said, they seem like they can get into anything. So you, to plant trees, as Jane Rossing has said and others, first of all, the water. If you don't have water, it's not like here where you go up and put trees in the hill and some are going to grow, or in Minnesota, they're going to grow. There, they've got to be watered in the beginning, and that means back-breaking labor. Then you got to protect them from the goats. And, you know, it's a battle. It sounds easy to say we're going to build a green belt across Senegal and there's going to be forests all over. It's a struggle. Now, they do have some woodlots too, but that's slow going also. And you just rejoice when you come into a village and see some trees. They shade trees, sometimes fruit trees. This is the neem tree, which is pretty sturdy if it can live, grow, so it can, you know, the goats don't get at it. Also, a lot of people who haven't had trees don't realize why they should spend time on growing, you know, why should I grow a tree? I'd rather have a garden, or I'd rather, you know, not do anything. So reforestation has been a tough thing up there, and the government works on it, and non-governmental organizations like aid organizations and our church. That There are some small lots too, kind of woodlots, but there you have to have tremendously good fences. And one of the debates up there has been, do you get wire fence, woven wire fence? Can people afford that? No, and if you don't, the goats get in. So there's no real, there are people doing research and there's some good things happening, but there's a long, long ways to go. Gus Ziegler, you saw earlier, the farmer, pastor from northern Minnesota, also does some veterinary work as he goes around. They have a sick sheep or a sick horse. He'll and it's kind of a, you might say this is just a drop in the bucket, but again, it's showing concern for the people, trying to meet them where they are. If they say they have a sick goat or sick sheep or sick horse, and you can do something, you try to help them. And that's another way of hopefully building bridges and building some relationships. Also, another way, this is Betty Ziegler, Gus's wife, in the little town. They live in a little town and they travel out. They have a little, they in the place where they, which we bought, the church bought, a little bit of a center, reading center with some books, and they have literacy classes. It's Église Evangélique Luthérienne de Senegal, and they call it Gali Nanandiro, which is Fulani for a place of mutual discourse. So, and the idea is that people come in there and you can sit and talk to them again, building slowly, slowly building relationships, building bridges. And they have a small ping pong table, they have a reading room, they'll have classes in French or sometimes in Fulani, because people can speak it but they can't write it or read it. And they want to learn how to write, to read and write it. And there's Betty, another place where they go once a week. They have some books and they, again, just sit and talk with the young, some of the young women there. And I took that for a couple of reasons. One is to show what Betty's doing and also that beautiful hairdo. Then I mentioned medical, and again, the government is very concerned about the health of people, but it doesn't have the resources, in some cases doesn't have the will. And one of our first missionaries out there was Phil Mueller, who had served in Ethiopia. And Phil was a trained registered nurse and a pastor, and he operated some small clinics. The idea of the clinics was, again, to try to meet some of the needs of the people where they are. Meet the needs of the people and you know, show concern, and just another way of trying to build bridges in that one particular area. Now the emphasis we're trying to shift to, and we're not alone, many governments and agencies, is to more primary health care. And Sushila Engelbrecht, and if any of you are from Seattle area, you might know the Engelbrechts. Her father is a pastor in the Missouri Synod, was a missionary in India for many years. She was born in India and now and served in Africa before, now works with us as a nurse. She has a master's degree in public health care. She's been out there a year. And what she is trying to do in this picture, one of the small clinics, is to, in a certain area, working with the government in about, I don't know, how many villages they work in now, say five, I don't know what they started with, they have local people form health committees. So local people will be concerned about the health in their own area. And they also have this cart to travel between some of the villages so that it's a more interesting way to travel. And they try to have a health committee in each town of those, if the people are interested. And then they come and also have clinics for the people. They have prenatal clinics, postnatal clinics. They talk about nutrition. Of course, they talk about, you know, the proper food. They do immunization for children. And the idea is that people themselves have to build these huts. Now this is in a place, I don't think they built this, but in some of the places they have to build their own huts. They can be very simple huts. And then she comes by once a week and meets with the people, and again is trying to help people take control of a little bit of their own lives. There's one of the huts that they built, two huts. Another place, pretty fancy. Now the last slides, we switch to the urban setting. The first few years that we were involved in Senegal, we realized that we were basically working in the rural areas, and we began to realize very quickly. So the people said, how are we going to reach out in this tremendous metropolitan area of Dakar? There are some churches there, the Roman Catholics are there, there's some small, it's a small Protestant church. So after a lot of discussion and false starts and difficulties, a number of years, the missionaries working in there They decided we should work in a certain area called Yembul. It's one of the sections, we call it a suburb, but it's probably 10 miles from downtown. It's just solid Muslim, about half are Fulani speaking. And our missionaries found a building there which had not been finished. It was standing there, just a cement block building. And so as they thought, maybe the best thing we can do is try to build a center where the youth especially can come in. And anyone can come, but the youth, there are thousands and thousands of kids who go to school and don't have jobs. One of the problems of Senegal, which no one's going to solve very quickly, is what happens when these kids finish, if they're lucky enough to finish junior high or high school.
Are there any requirements on how long they have to go to school?
There's not compulsory education. But more and more they want to go, you know, and they go to school and then when they get out there's nothing to do. That's the flip side, the bad side. So our two missionaries there, John Berg on the right and Dan Hart in the middle, after a lot of struggle, started a small center, and there they're with a friend talking about literature for Fulani. And then they bought this building, which was not finished, and finished it, and opened it up as a youth center for that whole area. And they there you see Gali Nanandero, the same name, a place of mutual discourse, opened by the Lutheran Church of Senegal on the 22nd of December, and I'm trying to remember if it was 80, I think it was 87. It's just quite new, some of the kids who come in. To come in that center, you have to pay a minimal fee, like 25, 30 cents, I don't know what it is in our money. And you have to have a little card. And there are over 2,000 kids that, in a sense, belong to that center. The number grows. There's a library. It's Beb Hart, the wife of Dan Hart. These books are mostly French. There's a reading room, which is almost always full. Some of it is just for kids in high school or even college who need a place to study. They don't have a place in their own home. Like someone said, you study about electricity by candlelight. You know, well, that's about what happens. So, and there are some who just come in and grab some comic books or something and read, that's fine. But a lot of them are, it's serious study. And that room has about 75 seats and it's almost always full. That's not a good picture, but I couldn't get a good one. I wanted to show something. You have sewing classes for women and also for younger women. And I couldn't get a good picture. Also, they weren't, it's kind of hard. They really weren't that interested. I don't blame them because I'm